Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. Some of you are going to come in, I think, with a little bit of a lag. My fault, some of the technical stuff. So I'm waiting for YouTube to get fully here. Should be any minute now. Let's see. All right. We're live on YouTube. We're live on Facebook. We are live on Periscope. And we're live on Blog Talk Radio. And I've got a screen for each one of those, plus a few other screens all open in front of me right now. So fun stuff. All right, I'm really looking forward to today's show. We've got a good friend of mine, Bradley Thompson, Dr. Bradley Thompson, although I'm going to call him Brad, from Clemson University. And I'm just going to give you the kind of the highlights of his bio quickly. Brad is the BB&T research professor in the Department of Political Science at Clemson University, and more importantly, from my perspective at least, the executive director of the Clemson Institute for the Study of Capitalism. And in the kind of the second part of our discussion today, we're going to talk about the Clemson Institute for the Study of Capitalism. In particular, we're going to talk about a program of the Clemson Institute called the Lyceum Scholars Program. And, you know, so start thinking about that, because the way I think I put it in the title is Institute called the Lyceum Scholars.
The antidote
for all the stuff we're going to talk about in the first part of the interview, right? The first part of the interview is of the discussion really is going to be about school shootings and progressive education and nihilism and the connection between all of those things. And then we're going to end on a more positive note about what the solution is, and we're going to talk about the Lyceum Scholars. Brad got his PhD at Brown University. And has been a visiting scholar at Princeton and at Harvard and University of London. He's written a number of books, probably most well known for the books he wrote on John Adams. He is one of the world scholars on John Adams, and also written a collection of essays or put together a collection of writings on anti-slavery. And wrote a book on freedom and school choice in American education. And as Brad likes to say, my favorite book of his, because I was a minor co-author on it, Neoconservatism and a Bitchian Idea. Brad, thanks for coming on the Iran Book Show. It's great to have you.
Hey, Iran, it's great to be on the show. It's great to see you in Puerto Rico. And I've been watching your show faithfully now for several months, and this is a genuine thrill.
Good. I'm excited. Yeah, we're starting to get people are coming through on Facebook and on YouTube. I can see the numbers. It's good. We build up audiences as the show goes on, and then it kind of ebbs and flows over time. Let's jump right in. I mean, you wrote a series of essays, the first one really being, I think, an op-ed for the Ayn Rand Institute in 1999 on school shootings and the relationship between the school shootings and kind of the state of education in America. And then you've written a number of longer essays since then. The one I've read most recently was published in 2014 in the Social Sciences and Modern Society Journal, on the relationship between school shootings and progressive education. So first, give us a sense of, is this a real big issue, the school shootings? Because, you know, some people say, well, you know, these things happen, and it's not that often. And there have been shootings throughout American history, so now they're in schools. What's the big deal?
No, I think it is a big deal. And these shootings, these mass shootings, have been taking place now for just over 20 years. So, there were very few mass school shootings, right? There are always school shootings on schools, but throughout probably the 20th century, but most of those school shootings were directed at particular individuals,
yeah,
right?
Some grievance.
So,
yeah.
You know, you broke up with my girlfriend, bang, you're dead.
Yeah.
You stole my jacket, bang, you're dead, right? So we've always had that kind of violence, but then something strange, something new happens in, I think, American cultural history. So starting in 1997, you had your first mass school shooting. And then over the course of 4 or 5 years, you had a whole series of them. So, you know, your listeners and viewers, you know, might remember them just by their location. So interestingly enough, it's mostly small town America, Pearl, Mississippi, West Paducah, Kentucky, Jonesboro, Arkansas. And then, of course, the most famous one being in Littleton, Colorado at Columbine High School.
Yep.
There was one in Ohio, one in Santee, California. And the number of people shot in these shootings, varied from 4 or 5 shot and killed, sometimes, but with many, many injured, up to, 14, which was the number at Columbine. So in a very short period of time, you had a number of mass shootings, and these shootings didn't seem to have a particular motive connected with them. Right. And that's what was strange about these shootings. And, as I watched these in the late 1990s, of course, the public conversation about them was just as it is now in the light of the Parkland, Florida shooting. Right. It was liberals blaming guns for the shootings. And now they blame what they call toxic masculinity. And conservatives blaming video games and lack of school prayer and sometimes, other, breakup of the family, that kind of thing. And as I was watching the round the clock coverage over the Columbine shooting, none of this seemed to strike a chord with me. It just didn't seem right. And, I've never told you this before. The op-ed that I wrote for you in 1999, which was titled Our Killing Schools, it came to me as a kind of an epiphany. Not to tell you and your listeners more than they want to hear, but I was actually, I had gone to bed and I was just falling asleep. And then all of a sudden it hit me. And what hit me was, these shootings all have one thing in common that nobody was talking about.
Yep.
Right? And the one thing that they all had in common was that they all took place at school, and they all took place in a government school. And nobody had asked that question had analyzed it in that way in particular. So I started wondering, well, what's going on here? Why are America's teenage boys shooting up America's government schools?
So before we get to your answer, one of the things that struck me in the article is you make the argument, you provide the evidence, that not only of the school, the number of school shootings gone up, the idea that there's no, they're not shooting it up for any particular cause. That is, it's not a grievance that they have. It's more of a grievance against reality, but they don't have a particular grievance. But the point I didn't realize is the point you make up of all the school shootings that have been avoided. That is, all the school shootings where the kids were caught before they did it. And that, I think, nobody talks about, right? So when the police arrest some kid who's been planning this or is building bombs in his basement, I think it makes the second page of the newspaper, or maybe in the local paper it makes news, but it doesn't have a big headline. So we don't realize that it's even a much bigger problem than what's actually going on, because there's all these things that are being stopped, luckily, right? And so this is a much, much broader phenomena than even most of us suspect.
Oh, it is a much broader phenomenon than we know. And in a number of these instances, these boys were caught just as they got to school, right?
Yep.
With their cars loaded with weapons. And then the other thing, which nobody talks about and which is important, particularly relative to the gun debate going on in this country right now, the weapon of choice for many boys, teenage boys, after Columbine was a bomb. So you can ban all the guns in the world,
yeah,
right? But if a kid comes to school with a bomb, you know, you've got no defense against it.
And you can build those fairly easily. I mean, there are tutorials on YouTube on how to build a pipe bomb.
Yeah, yeah. It's much easier to build a bomb today than it was 20 years ago.
Yep.
And a little known fact is that Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris at Columbine, their goal, their explicit goal, was to kill every single person at Columbine High School. That's over 2,000 students and teachers. And the principal means by which they were going to do that were bombs. And they had built their bombs, and they had placed the bombs in the cafeteria at the high school. The problem was the bombs didn't go off.
Yeah.
That's why they went bombs didn't go off and they went on their shooting spree,
yep.
Which they would have done anyway. But the point being, right, there have been several dozen boys around the country arrested for conspiracy to bomb their school, right? Which I think makes the gun debate over schools right now mute. But of course, the gun debate over the schools today
is not
about
schools.
The school.
It's not
yeah,
about schools.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, it occurred to me that obviously something more was going on,
yeah.
And we weren't Americans. We're not asking the right questions, right? We shouldn't be asking, how did they kill? We need to be asking, why did they kill? Right? That's the single most important question that nobody is talking about. So if you watch the round-the-clock coverage on CNN or on Fox or the regular networks, it's all about guns.
Yep.
That's it, right? No, I have never once heard a single commentator on this issue ask the question why. And the question is, why are large numbers of America's teenage boys committing mass murder at their schools, right? Why? And it seems to me what they're doing is they are attacking the school, right? Because they're not going there with particular individuals that they're trying to kill. This is an attack on the school, generally speaking, right? So now the question is, why? Why are America's teenage boys so full of anger and rage, right? Why are they alienated from just sort of the basic norms of moral decency?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a question that nobody's asking. And so that was really what was behind my essay.
Yeah, no, and I think the left is afraid to ask that question because of the answers and the right. The only framework in which it can ask the question and answer the question is with religion. There is no other moral framework that they can relate to. And that's why they fall back on kind of the conventional explanations. Yeah, if we only had more school prayer, or if we only had more fathers in the home or whatever it happens to be, they're non-ideological. In some regards, they're anti-ideological. So they can't think about ideas driving this. And of course, this is what's partially unique about objectivism is we understand the role of ideas, not just in history, but in shaping individuals and in shaping cultures and in shaping the events of history, the events that are happening within the culture. So once you realized that was the question to be asked, was it obvious to you that it was progressive education or that require research? Where did you go from realizing that was the question to the actual answer to the question?
Yeah, well, before I got to progressive education, there were several other facts about these shootings that nobody was really thinking about or talking about. So first, it's very interesting. In every single instance, the shooter was middle-class boy from small-town or suburban America, right? So there have been, as far as I know, there haven't been any mass shootings in cities, particularly in inner city schools, which is interesting. Now, you know, I don't want this to be about guns because I refuse to talk about this issue on guns. But many years ago, actually after my op-ed for you first came out, I was sort of on a lecture tour around the country. I gave a lot of talks on this issue. And oftentimes it was to high school and college age students. And I'll never forget this. I gave a talk, I think somewhere in Colorado, and I asked this room full of college students if they thought this kind of shooting could take place at their school. It was and the result was very interesting. Every single kid in that room put their hand up and said, yes, this kind of shooting could take place at my school. But it's even more interesting, Yaron. There was one student who didn't put his hand up. Right.
Yeah.
And it was an African American young man from the inner city. And so I said, I asked him, why do you think this kind of shooting wouldn't take place at your school? His answer was very interesting. He said, because everybody at my school carries a gun.
not a good phenomenon, by the way.
No, of course not.
Not
a good phenomenon.
In that case.
And you know, in many inner city schools, there are shootings, right?
Yeah.
But it's the kind I described a minute ago, right?
But I think there's something more going on here, though, and maybe we can talk about when we talk about progressive education, and that is that there's something about the impact progressive education has on middle class kids that I don't think it would have on somebody who's poor and just trying to survive. I just don't think, I don't think this kind of nihilism is a phenomena that you see among poor people. It's a phenomena of the middle class. It's a phenomena of a certain comfort level with your existence. And it's a rebellion against existence that to some extent, I think can only come from a position of comfort.
Yeah, no, exactly. And you know the other factors that I took into account in when I did a kind of sociological sketch of these boys is that the average age of these boys is 15.
Yeah, stunning.
So now the question is, what's wrong with America's 15-year-old boys? And the other thing, I mean, with the possible exception, in fact, with the exception of this last shooting in Florida, almost all of the boys. 15 years old, white, from small town or middle class America, and they all seem to be sort of your image of a Boy Scout, right? They all seem to look perfectly normal. In fact, many of them just seem to be rather nerdish, right? And many of them were sort of very intelligent boys. And so, in other words, my sense of the matter, right, was that we had created the schools in particular, which was ultimately where I was heading. Is that the schools had created a generation of lost boys who acting out in a kind of nihilistic rage, resentment, and anger, and a kind of profound ennui that they had built up over the course, not just of their time at high school, because most of these boys were in ninth or 10th grade.
Yeah.
So it's not simply the high school experience. It's something that had been building up. And by the way, many of the threatened bombing attacks and the threatened shootings that happened after Columbine were done at middle school.
Yep.
So all of this, you know, it tells, I mean, the lessons that I was coming to, of course, were entirely different than what one was getting in the mainstream culture. So I started thinking, trying to think more seriously and deeply about what was going on. And it occurred to me, to sort of repeat for the second time, that these were attacks on the schools. So if we want to find the answer as to why they are attacking the schools, maybe we should look at the schools, right? Maybe we should look inside the schools. Maybe we should look at what's being taught in the classroom and how it's being taught. And so that was my aha moment when I thought, okay,
that's great.
We've got to look in a completely different place. And that was when I first started, started thinking seriously and deeply about elementary and secondary education, which I had never really thought about very much before.
So you hadn't studied the progressives in the context of education before you started looking at this?
A little bit.
Okay.
But the only reason I had been studying it and just then even just a little bit was, not surprisingly, for the reasons that most at the time, I was obviously much younger, I had children.
Yeah. Yeah.
I had young children. And the question was, how are my wife and I going to educate our three kids? And so I became, in fact, when I first became interested in progressive education was the year that we were living in London, England. where there was an education debate going on in the country that was front page on the broadsheets. It seemed like two or three times a week, right? Because it was the end of the Thatcher Revolution. John Major was prime minister, but they were trying to still implement Margaret Thatcher's reforms. And so there was a huge debate taking place in England. And I was there in 1995, 96 with my wife and a four-year-old child. And so all of a sudden now it became very real to me. And over the course of the next couple of years, you know, I did take an interest in progressive education, particularly in the issue of how we were teaching our children to read. Because there was a massive debate, yep, both in Britain and in the United States about reading. And so, you know, over the course of a couple of years, I started having very clear and certainly strong opinions about progressive education, and more particularly, I followed the reading wars very closely.
So let's talk a little bit about what progressive education is, where it comes from, the progressives, the James Dewey, and then kind of tie it all together kind of once we get an understanding of what progressive education is, because people hear about progressives, you know, but I don't know that many people realize the impact the progressives had on education and what Dewey in particular, what that whole philosophical approach to education means how it manifests itself.
Yeah, well, the fact of the matter is there is only progressive education, or at least in the 20th century, there was only progressive education in the formal government schools, right? So John Dewey, the godfather of progressive education in the 1910s and 1920s, Dewey was a philosopher, probably America's best known philosopher, the philosopher of pragmatism. But he also became very interested in elementary and secondary education. So he started writing a series of treatises, and his ideas on education and the development of idea of progressive education just swept over the country sort of like a tsunami. And in a very short time, I mean, by the end of the 1920s into the 1930s, virtually all of the teacher colleges in America were run by Dewey acolytes.
Wow.
Right? And so now the question, I mean, what is progressive education? Well, let's start with the theory of progressive education. So first you have to start with what progressive education rejects. And progressive education certainly rejects, you know, traditional values and methods of teaching and learning. It absolutely rejects the classical curriculum. It rejects the idea of the teacher as the transmitter of knowledge. It rejects what it calls the drill and kill method of teaching. I mean, any traditional form of education, the progressives rejected. They rejected the idea that the purpose of education was to train the mind.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a total rejection of everything that had gone before. Now, what does progressive education support? Well, the first is that it supports a kind of child-centered curriculum, the purpose of which is to liberate the individual, to liberate individuality and creativity and self-expression in children, right? So you don't have children sitting anymore at individual desks in rows. You now have children sitting at tables in groups, and it's totally unstructured education, not to be confused with Montessori education. And the way it works is teachers just sort of flit around the classroom. They give students assignments, and the assignments are always group assigned,
mm-hmm,
and in the form of games. So learning for the progressive educators becomes a game, because they want to liberate what they call the naturalistic tendencies of children to learn on their own. But of course, it's much more invidious than that, because the idea of liberating individuality and creativity and self-expression is, you know, it might sound good, but it's the liberation of the desires and the passions of children. It's not to train their minds in any way.
Yeah, right? It's not individuality in any rational, meaningful sense. It's not creativity or any of those things in the way we would understand it. It's emotionalism. It's the primacy of emotion and the primacy of the child's consciousness over reality, over facts, over knowledge, over logic, which is really what they're pushing.
Dewey described it as the primacy of the impulse.
Yeah.
Right? Which I think sums it up. But in the end, progressive education, though in many ways I think it's most famous for this idea of the liberation of the child, in the end, this idea of individuality is not the same thing as individualism. They do not take the individual, an individual child, as the primary unit of intellectual and moral value. They take the collective. And you know, Dewey uses language like this. He talks about the collective. And ultimately, the purpose of all of this individuality and creativity is to destroy the mind such that children can be socialized. Socialization and submission, collective, is the end goal of progressive education. And that's clear to anybody who reads Dewey's writings.
Yeah, and the genius of it is Dewey understood, as most of these authoritarians understand, that to collectivize people, the thing you have to destroy, the thing you must attack, is the individual human mind. It's reason and rationality that have to be undercut and destroyed. And if people are left just as emotional beings, just... What was it? Not impulses. You said left to their whatever, impulses or emotions, then they become, I think you write in the article, they become scared, they become terrified, they become confused, and they look to the group for answers. Where are they going to get the answers, if not from the group or the leader? So it's training them for the collectivization.
Yeah, it absolutely is, right? And you see this. This has been the dominant form of education. Progressive education has been the dominant form of education in the United States, really throughout the entire 20th century. And first, Dewey and his acolytes took over the education schools, right? So the education schools were the transmitters of progressive education. And then slowly over the course of the 20th century, every single person who ends up teaching in a government school, right, it has to be trained through one of these education schools, and the only thing they get is progressive education. I mean, I do not know of a single education school in America that teaches anything other than progressive education.
I mean, just to you know, have to say something positive. Yeah, I mean, I do think there are teachers who don't succumb. And who, just because of reality, not because they know a lot, and they're good teachers out there, and they're teachers who don't use progressive. And I think high schools are less impacted by this than the early stages. And I think that's why, when we get to the school shootings, that's why it's so young, because I actually think most of the damage and of progressive education is done in pre-K through... because in high school, you kind of have a little bit of structure. You're studying physics and you're studying, you know, math in the kind of more traditional sense. But in the early ages, did I ever tell you about my school in Brookline, Massachusetts that I went to?
No, I don't think so.
So in 1974, my father was working at MIT and we came from Israel. And they put me in what was considered the best school in Massachusetts, one of the best schools in the country. And it was Dukakis's kids went to the same school I did, right? And this is a school that had no walls. So all the classrooms were just open areas. You sat on beanbags on the floor. There were no desks, right? And it was all chatting and kumbaya and stuff like that. And the teacher taught what she felt like teaching that day. It was all about whatever the teacher felt like teaching. My brother, 1 year... had no math because the teacher felt like it was more appropriate to teach Russian, 1974. That year, he had no math. It was a complete, I fell behind by 2 years relative to my Israeli compatriots in 1 year at the school. It was such a complete disaster. And for me, having come from an Israeli system that was rigorous, it was like, what is this? It was so strange and bizarre and obviously stupid. But you know, these were upper middle class and middle class kids. This is where the experiments were run. The smart parents were sending their kids to these experimental schools where this garbage was done. So I've lived it. I had to work hard to make up and catch up with my Israeli colleagues.
No, I lived it too in Canada, right? Because progressive education was just as much in Canada as it was in the United States and in Britain. So, you know, I lived the progressive dream in elementary and secondary school, and it was horrible. I mean, I can tell you, certainly my high school years were the five worst years of my life, without question. I mean, literally. And of course, in Canada, I mean, for those who are wondering why I went to high school for 5 years, it's not because I failed, but it's because we have, when I was there in high school in the 1970s, we had grade 13. Now talk about cruel and unusual punishment, right? Locking somebody up in a kind of mental ward for 5 years was horrible. And I had a couple of classes, of course, in high school that were pretty good, but it was all, of course, progressive education. It was all group learning. The only true education that I got when I was in high school was in grade 13. After the football season ended, I just stopped going to school. And my father worked in downtown Toronto, and I would drive in with him early in the morning at 6 o'clock in the morning. And he would drop me off at the Metropolitan Library in Toronto. And I spent weeks and weeks by myself in the Metropolitan Library, just pulling books off the shelf and reading.
Wow.
And that was the single best education that I got in 5 years.
I have to say the Israeli system was much better, because we sat in classrooms. We got, you know, it was a good education as compared to what I think is possible. But it wasn't, there were very few group assignments. There was no class discussion. You had real homework. You were challenged. You were expected to know stuff. And I don't know if that's still that way in Israel. Probably not. And Israel's educational quality has gone down dramatically. And in the UK, my sense is they still have more of a classical education, at least in the private, you know, upper class schools, the Eatons and the places like that.
Yeah, in what they call the public schools, Yeah, right. The public schools like Westminster and Eton.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean they have certainly, relative to all other schools, they have very high standards.
Yeah.
But we shouldn't fool ourselves that these schools are immune to progressivism.
Oh no.
I mean in the United States, what are the feeder schools for the Ivy League schools? It's all of the New England prep schools like Choate and Andover, and those schools are worse than the government schools when it comes to progressive education. It's entirely politicized in our very best prep schools.
Yeah, no, that doesn't surprise me at all. And my experience in Orange County is when my kids went to high school, the public school actually was mildly better than the private school.
Right.
I mean, the private school was a bunch of, you know, they went to secular private schools, a bunch of lefty parents who, you know, signed up for, it was a very, other than math and science, the school was awful. It was just awful. So these are the options we're stuck with. So let's bridge between what is it about this kind of education that would lead some kids, and obviously not all kids are going to be impacted like this in this way,
right,
towards this kind of nihilistic behavior, towards these nihilistic ideas?
Right. So I think the way to get at that question is to start with boys in elementary school, and more particularly, let's focus on reading, for instance. So for the last, let's call it now almost 50 years, there has certainly been a debate in the United States, the so-called reading wars, between traditional phonics as the way to teach children how to read versus the so-called whole language or whole word methods. Phonics, of course, recognizes that there are 44 phonemes in the English language, and the way you begin to teach a child how to read is have that child learn the 44 phonemes, the sounds of the English alphabet. And once you learn the sounds and the sounds as they are connected to the letter itself, the visible display of the letter, then children can learn to teaching children to read with phonics is very simple, it's very easy, and it's very quick.
Yep.
Kids can learn how to read very quickly through phonics.
Yep.
I'll give you one concrete example of how and why that's the case. It comes from my own family. So as you know, we are a homeschooling family, and we started homeschooling when my oldest son was 4 years old. So he would sit at the kitchen table, and my wife was teaching him how to read using a very, very sort of hardcore phonics method. And our second son, who was 2 years old at the time, would sit at the kitchen table, and you know, he would do coloring books while his older brother was being taught how to read. Well, this went on for a year, and when we moved back to Ohio, we were living in Utah at the time, and when we moved back, we put our second son, who now was 3 years old, in a preschool. And I went in for the Christmas meeting with the teacher, and she just said very offhandedly, you know, she said, you know, Samuel can read. And I said, what?
What
do you mean Samuel can read? Of course Samuel cannot read. He's 3 years old, and we haven't taught him how to read. And she said, well, yes, he can. I said, no, he can't. And she said, yes, he can. So she said, go home and pull out a book, simple children's reading primer. And have him read for you. So I immediately went home, pulled a book off the shelf, put it in front of him, and said, Samuel, can you read this? And of course, then he proceeded to read it. So the question is how and why? Well, the fact of the matter is,
he was listening.
He was listening, precisely. That's it. He was listening.
Yeah.
Right. And he would watch the flashcards with the letters on them, and he learned to read. And we never taught them. So, I mean, that just shows you how easy and simple and right and correct the phonemic method of teaching is.
And phonics has 40 things you have to remember, right? 40 connections.
44.
Things. Yes, 44. Yep. All right. Just guys, remember that when Brad tells you how much you have to remember when you get to the Site C method or the whole language method.
Yeah. And then there is the whole language method, right? Which was in various forms, was starting to be introduced into America's government schools in the 1950s, but it really took off in the 1970s. And so what's the whole language method? The whole language method of teaching children how to read begins with children memorizing whole words. So they don't learn the 44 phonemes of the English language. They are taught to memorize words. And what happens is, starting in kindergarten or first grade, all the children in the class are sent home, let's say with 10 cue cards. And on each cue card is a simple word, bad, let's say, the word bad or mad or cat, right? And the child is to study the cue card, right? Just to look at it, look at the word and memorize the whole word. And then in addition to that, they are encouraged to take a pencil and outdraw an outline around the shape of the word. So, I mean, it's extraordinary. I mean, it's using the hieroglyphic method of reading for an alphabetic language. And so now let's trace this out for a young boy through school. So a young boy, and for reasons which social scientists do not yet fully understand, young boys are not able to memorize as many words as young girls are, right? So for several years, these kids are being taught, they're being taught to memorize words. And, you know, these kids can memorize about 1,500 words, right? But so little Johnny is doing okay. He's memorizing these words, but then he gets to fourth grade, and in fourth grade, now he's not learning how to read. He's being required to read in all of his subjects because now he's taking history and geography and science and math, and he has to read. And so the number of words that he's being exposed to go well beyond the simple Basel readers. So now he's being required to read books with potentially tens of thousands of words in them. So let's fast forward now to our little boy in the fourth grade. And in a whole language classroom, teachers will typically have these books that they read from are huge, right?
Yeah, yeah.
They're 3 feet, they're 2 feet by 3 feet or bigger, right? And they put them on easels. And on the left side of the page is the story, the words. On the right side of the page is a picture. And so little Johnny is asked to stand up and read, and to read from this. the question is, what happens when he gets to words that he hasn't memorized or can't remember? Well, he's given three clues. He can guess.
Yep.
That's the word based on the picture on the accompanying page. He can guess at the word based on the first letter clue of the word, or he can guess at the word based on its shape.
Yep.
It's insane. I mean, it's truly insane.
So what does this do to psychology?
Well,
that's where we get you, right? I mean, that's. And to his self-esteem.
Yeah. So imagine this four-year-old boy who's asked to stand up in front of his classmates and read, right? And it turns out he can't read or can't read very well. His first reaction, of course, is embarrassment.
Yep.
But then the embarrassment turns into a kind of frustration. And then the frustration turns into anger. And then finally the anger turns into resentment, right? And then what happens? Well, what happens is that Johnny starts acting out in class, right? Which in part, I think, in large measure, I would say, explains the exponential rise in young boys in elementary school being diagnosed with ADD, ADHD,
yep.
Right? There has been an explosion in the number of boys who have been diagnosed with it. And then what is America doing with its young boys who are being diagnosed with ADD and ADHD?
We're drugging them.
Precisely. That's precisely right. The government school system is America's largest drug dealer.
Yeah.
I mean, it's true. I once met a physician who told me that he has teachers come to him all the time asking him to prescribe Ritalin for kids in their classes.
Yeah.
So what you have now are untrained elementary school teachers diagnosing young boys with ADD, ADHD, and then wanting them prescribed with Ritalin.
Yeah.
I mean, it's extraordinary. And so you've got a whole generation of young boys now. I think the number is something like 15% of America's boys are on Ritalin.
No, I mean, my mother actually admits that if Ritalin had existed when I was a kid, she would have, you know, they would have given it to me because I was a handful and I was ADHD.
Really?
Yeah, surprise, I know. and I was what was then called hyperactive. And restless in class, and never, my teachers always said, never lived up to my potential, and would be a, you know, minor troublemaker. And I can't imagine what would happen to somebody like me in the school system today.
I think the proper diagnosis for you when you were that age,
bored,
is that you, no, well, yes, bored for sure.
Yeah.
The proper diagnosis is that you were a boy.
Yeah. Well, some boys are more boys than others. I was curious. I was engaged. I used to, yeah, and I was bored. And when a boy is bored, they become physical. I mean, that's what you do. I mean, you exert physicality.
You do. And then the icing on the cake for the progressive educators, right, is now they are banning recess, or they're banning certain kinds of games at recess.
They're banning recess.
Banning dodgeball, for instance, right? Yeah. Kids can no, you know, particularly boys, and they're not allowed to play tag. Tag and dodgeball. I'm not kidding. I'm not making this up. I couldn't make this up.
And you're not allowed to win. That's the other thing. You're not allowed to have competitive sports where you win.
Yeah. So imagine what this does for boys who have lots of energy and lots of competitive energy. I mean, they're being artificially not only medicated but suppressed. Right. Their boyness is being suppressed.
Now, do we know if any of these shooters were murderers were on Ritalin
Yeah. So when I last looked at this, and it has been a while, I mean, I was doing research on this stuff in 1999, 2000. Yeah. So it really has been now quite a long time since I've looked at it. But in the early shootings, right? So the shootings between 1997 and 2005, based on the information I was able to find, half of these boys were on Ritalin.
Wow.
Yeah,
right,
the boys at Columbine.
Yeah. So let's talk about this transition from that kind of frustration to nihilism and what's the mixture there? How does that happen? And how relates this pseudo self-esteem or to the lack of self-esteem? I mean, these kids have zero. They have negative self-esteem. I mean, they hate themselves. They hate reality. They hate the world. Otherwise, they couldn't do what they do.
That's absolutely true. And some of it starts with hating America, right? So the with the introduction of identity politics and multiculturalism in the government schools today, U.S. history basically now is taught, particularly the most important period of American history, namely the founding period. Is taught to small children as though America's founding fathers were all racist, sexist, homophobic tyrants, right? And so from the very beginning, they're taught there are no heroes. They're not taught any kind of heroism. They're taught that America's great entrepreneurs, inventors, and statesmen, that they were all corrupt, that they had no admirable virtues. So there's that part of it. But I'd say without question, the sort of reigning moral orthodoxy of the government schools today is without question the idea of moral relativism,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
The kids are taught that there are no moral absolutes, And not only are there no moral absolutes, that they're taught that they should not judge others, right? So they live in a world, to use the Christian term phrase, the biblical phrase, judge not lest ye be judged, right? But now it's secularized.
Yep.
It's the secularization
yep.
of that idea. And more importantly, that's the negative. On the positive side, I mean, their positive view, it's horrendous, is the idea that all morality is subjective. And all morality is just an expression of one's impulses, desires, passions, and the whole. So, in other words, what they're doing is liberating and then ultimately praising the subjective desires and impulses of kids, and telling them that it's good, that it's all okay, and that they should be proud of it.
Yeah.
Right. And so in other words, these kids are being stripped they're being stripped of whatever moral education that they got at home, right? So the morality of the government schools, for the most part around the country, is anathema to the kind of moral teachings that children are learning at home. So that also creates a kind of confusion in their minds, right? So they're taught moral relativism, but the purpose of that moral relativism is at least in part, is to be directed against the moral code that they learn at home. right? So that creates
to the extent that they even learn them all code at home. I think I think that's happening less and less, right?
Well, it's happening less and less because the parents of these kids went to government schools.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So they're the products of the same educational system now. It's been enough generations. But the Billy Moss subjectivism, the standard of truth is their emotions or the group's emotions. They have no self-esteem. They're negative self-esteem. They get a sense of their own incompetence and their own. They don't belong in the world. I think they really feel that they don't belong in the world. I think actually Jordan Peterson is pretty good on describing kind of the mentality of this nihilism, this rage against existence. It's not even rage against the school. It's against reality. And the school is just a vehicle. The school is the vehicle that's caused them this angst, this existential angst. And they lash out in the most horrific way imagined.
They do. But what complicates this in a very bad way is, and I sort of call this the fourth pillar of progressive education, which is the use and teaching of a kind of pseudo or bogus self-esteem in the government schools.
Yeah.
So the kids from day one are taught to like themselves, right? Just for the sake of liking themselves, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I can't, like, I'm not smart enough or funny enough to make this up. There are schools in the United States, elementary schools, that have, these would be sort of, you know, kindergarten, first grade, with mirrors in them. Is a sign which says you're now looking at the most important person in the whole wide world.
They haven't done anything. They haven't earned anything. They haven't achieved anything, but they are important.
Yeah, no, precisely.
Yeah.
And so throughout elementary school, I mean, you know, many of these teachers, and you're right, what you said earlier, look, teachers, I don't know what percentage, but many, many teachers in the United States in the government school system are good, decent, smart, and honorable people who love teaching, who love kids, who love the subject matter they teach. They have a passion for it. In many ways, I mean, I feel just as sorry for the teachers as I do for the students.
Absolutely,
right? Because at least for these, for the best kind of teacher, because they are subjected to progressive education as much as the students are, and they are forced by mandate to use progressive teaching methods and techniques. So anyway, the point being is that, you know, going back to our, what I call the new model boy in my longer essay. So you've got a kid who in effect has been taught to think at the perceptual level. He's lost the sort of the conceptual ability to think. Right. This comes in reading. It comes in the math that's being taught. There's something in math that's called whole math. Right. It's the counterpart to the whole language reading technique. Whole math is just as crazy as whole language.
And the whole system is geared up to destroy reason and to destroy rationality. So it's in everything. Right. Because they're taught that their mind is impotent. And if you teach people their mind is impotent, they're going to do crazy things.
Yeah, you teach them that their mind is impotent, and you teach them that there are no true moral values. In fact, you deny the possibility of truth altogether, right?
Yep.
And you've created an environment, particularly these young boys have a kind of pent up anger and resentment, and you have taught them that their only moral imperative, right, is to sacrifice for the group. Right. But the problem is, particularly when they get to middle school, right, the moral lesson they've been taught in grammar school or elementary school is conformism.
Yeah.
Right. So they start conforming to the group. But anybody who knows anything about an American middle school knows that it's like a Hobbesian state of nature where life is nasty, poor, brutish and short.
Yeah.
Right. Where at least amongst the kids themselves, the egalitarianism that is being taught by the teachers is thrown out.
Yep.
And it's a very hierarchical society where there are winners and there are losers based on what you wear, based on how you look, how you talk, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think it probably is the case that a lot of these boys, yes, they do become outcasts. But imagine becoming an outcast after you've been told through 6 years of elementary school that you're the most important person in the world.
Yep. And that whatever you feel is true, whatever your emotions tell you is right. And when you start feeling anger and resentment and hatred and violent tendencies, that's all okay. And when you're told to sacrifice to the group, they never give you a reason for that. And some of these kids say, why the hell should I sacrifice to the group? That, you know, they I don't. And the only thing they can conceive of as the opposite, of course, of sacrificing the group is the destruction of the group. It's to destroy everybody
yeah.
around them. And that's exactly what they set out to do.
I think that's exactly right. So that takes us to high school. That takes us to boys who are in 9th and 10th grade. And the only thing that they've been left with is a kind of radical uncertainty, helplessness, aimlessness, impotence, right? That's in many ways what they feel most of all, is a kind of impotence.
Yep.
They have no genuine self-esteem because they've never done anything, in part because their minds have been destroyed, and they've been taught that the accomplishments and values and heroism are all bad things, and so they're left in a state of confusion, right?
And I guess it doesn't surprise me that it's the smarter kids, because I don't think you get a lot of high school quarterbacks going on school shootings.
Yeah.
And I think it's partially because these are the smarter kids who should be, really excelling. And they're not, because their mind is being crushed. It's being denigrated. It's being stepped on. The one tool that they have, they be told is impotent, and that's why they feel more impotent than anybody else. The high school quarterback can get the athletes can get by because they've got something to fall back on, their physicality. These kids are nerdy. They almost all look awkward. When you look at their pictures, they look like nerdy, awkward teenagers.
Exactly.
And I think that's not an accident, because it's their tool more than anything that is being just eviscerated through this process.
Exactly right. And so by the time they're in 9th and 10th grade, they come to identify all of their pain, their suffering, their hatred. They identify it with the school.
Yeah.
I mean, what else would they identify it with, right? That's why, it's interesting. None of these mass shootings place on the weekend.
Yep.
They don't take place on the weekend. And they
don't
take place
in the mall
or a sporting event
or anything like that.
Yeah, exactly. This is an attack. These are attacks on the school and what the school represents. And again, they're not targeted attacks at particular individuals for particular reasons.
Now, why do you think they don't happen in private schools? Because the education system is not that much better over in the private sector. I mean, it might be marginally better, but it's not that much better.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of time.
What's that?
You think it's just a matter of time?
Yeah, I mean, there have been a couple of cases of boys arrested for threatening to attack their schools, but private schools are also much smaller,
yeah.
right? So you don't have a 2,000, 3,000 size school, right?
Yeah.
And the other thing, Yaron, think about it. These schools, all of the attributes of prisons. They do. They have all of the attributes of prisons. They have armed guards. They have metal detectors. They have strip searches. They have closed circuit television monitors that are hooked up directly to police stations. They have doors. I mean, do you know what it's like if you wanted to visit your local government
school? I mean, I do all the time. So it's not quite as bad as you presented. I was just at a school in Santa Ana where the kids were gangbangers and all kinds. And I walked into the reception and they checked my ID and stuff, but there was no metal detectors and none of that. And indeed, the schools with the metal detectors are the ones where you don't get the school shootings, I think.
Yeah, so
back to your point about suburbia and where there's a much more relaxed attitude about violence in schools and things like that, where these are happening, it's the school's under siege. You don't get it as much. Just probability, you're going to see more public schools. Just they outnumber private schools by, I don't know, huge numbers. Yeah. So just the probabilities. And they're worse, right? The education is worse on average in a public school. And again, I think we characterized it. It's these middle class, suburbia, small America, where there's also nothing going on around them. Life is kind of dull beyond the school as well for these kids.
Yeah, yeah. And we live in a culture now where for high school students, their entire life is school.
Yeah.
Right? They're at school, what, 6, 7, 8 hours a day. And then they do extracurriculars, sports and various clubs. And so some of these kids are at school 10 hours a day.
Yeah.
Right? Their whole life it revolves around the school.
So just so we're not, people in the chat are citing with you on the armed guards part of the schooling stuff. So just in the name of equal or fairness. all right. So what's the solution? And let's first talk about kind of a big picture solution. And then we'll talk, about what you're doing in Clemson, because I think that's definitely the kind of the practical real solution we could do right now. But what is the ultimate solution to this problem?
It's simple. Very simple. Abolish America's government schools.
Yep.
That's the solution. And of course that's a radical solution, and that's not going to happen anytime in my lifetime, not in my kids' lifetime. But that is the solution to the problem. And, you know, you and I have had this conversation many times. And I think we share common views on this.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the number one policy issue, the most important political issue is the privatization of schools. It's getting the government out of schools, getting the teacher colleges, eliminate their monopoly over training teachers. I mean, even if it's little steps like charter schools and vouchers or whatever, even though they're not good solutions, they just break anything to break up the monopoly power that the government has on every aspect of these kids' education. Anything that fragments it right now is help. And then, of course, I mean, we have to demolish progressivism. I mean, the whole progressive educational philosophy has to be uprooted and discarded in the trash bin of history.
I have some friends, including objectivist friends, who think the solution to the problem is just to get rid of progressive education in the government schools and everything will be fixed.
No.
And that, of course, that is the neoconservative solution, right? The solution of people like Bill Bennett, who say if we can just get rid of progressive education and put in an old-fashioned pre-World War II curriculum, everything will be great again.
No.
And that's just, one, it's not true. Two, it doesn't solve the larger problem, which is that the government schools are inherently immoral.
Yep.
That's the bottom line. And as you know, over the course of the last 10 or 15 years, I have come out as an abolitionist.
Yep.
Right? An abolitionist in the tradition of the great 19th century anti-slavery abolitionists. I believe that the government school system is an inherently immoral system. It's because it's based on coercion. It's based on force. It's based on compulsory attendance laws. It's based on taxation. And it's also a form of propaganda, right?
Yeah,
you have government-trained teachers, government-created curricula, government-approved textbooks.
It's the whole idea of separation of church and state. At the heart of it is the idea of separation of state from ideas. The state has no business in the world of ideas. It is there to protect our rights and leave us alone. It's not there to dictate what knowledge is appropriate, what isn't, what history is right, what history is wrong, whether evolution is true or whether creationism is true. That is not the government's business. And as soon as it becomes the government's business, it's going to be corrupt. And if it's not progressive education, it's Bill Bennett style pseudo-classical education, you know, education to be a good Christian or a good citizen in the neoconservative sense of citizen,
right.
You know, a good collectivist by a different frame. So there's no way government schools can create the kind of innovation and competition that we deserve in our school system and the kind of education that our kids deserve. No, it has to be regimented. That's what the government does. That's the only thing it knows how to do.
Yeah, and the conservatives now are falling into a trap, right? So, of course, and the trap is about guns. The left wants to. They're using this crisis to confiscate guns. And conservatives are saying, well, what we need to do is make our schools safer, and we'll arm teachers.
Yeah.
Okay, now look, this is the stupidest idea I've ever heard, right? We're going to give government propagandists guns.
Yeah, we're going to
government propagandists guns in a classroom, right? Teaching our children, right?
Teachers who can't figure out that phonics is better than whole language.
Yeah.
We're going to give a gun to people like that.
Yeah. No, exactly.
I know.
Right?
I know. It's
propagandists with guns.
And is it one of the things I said on the show the other day was if you had private schools, schools that wanted to have armed guards would have armed guards and
yeah.
parents would decide whether to send their kids there. Schools that wanted to arm the teachers would arm the teachers and parents would
exactly.
have a choice. And schools that said no, a gun-free zone, nothing. And you'd get a choice as a parent which school you wanted to send your kids to and you'd assess the risk-return relationship. And for the government to do anything with regard to schools, arming them, armed guards, any of these things is dangerous and bad because it's the government doing it. It's none of the government's business to be engaged in this. But you're right. There's no solution short of privatization. There's no solution of getting rid of these schools. And again, I think fragmenting charter, I'm pro charter schools only because it's marginally better than what we have today. I think any fragmentation of their power is a good thing. But at the end of the day, it's only privatization. It's only absolute abolition that works.
Yeah.
That is the moral solution.
This is where you and I differ, and I regard you as a statist.
Yeah, I know.
For permitting charter schools and vouchers. Well,
permitting charter schools. Permitting as if I get to permit anything. I prefer them on no charter schools.
Right.
That's
yeah.
about as far
I
as
know.
I go.
I'm only teasing.
I know.
But, you know, I have written an article on free market education. So I've written
let me plug this article that you wrote first before we get to that one. So this is a journal article. Now, you can't actually get it, guys. Unfortunately, journals, they're only for academics. And so they don't put their stuff up online available. It's very expensive if you want to read the article online. But Brad has offered that if you want a copy of this article, which I recommend everybody get, he will email you a copy or send it to you through Facebook or something. So why don't you give your email address or the Facebook address, however you want people to contact you.
Sure. So my email address is ethomp2@clemson.edu. Or you can send me a private message on Facebook and I'll send it via Messenger on Facebook.
Yeah, it's called Our Killing Schools and it was published in Social Sciences and Modern Society. And
actually it wasn't.
It wasn't?
No. No, the name of the journal is Society.
Oh, okay. What's the Social Sciences and Modern on the side there?
I have no idea.
It's
I have no idea what you're talking
social
about.
Social Sciences and Modern, and in big font, Society.
Yeah, well, it's just called Society. That's
all
what
right.
it's called.
All right.
Just Society.
Society Journal. All right.
Yes. Yep.
All right. I'm just reading. That's all I'm doing.
Okay.
all right. So, and then tell us about the privatizing school book, and then we should go on to talk about Clemson.
Yeah, so it's actually, it's not the book so much as two articles that I wrote a number of years ago in the Objective Standard. One is called The New Abolitionism, which makes the argument for abolishing the government schools. And the second article is, I think the title is Free Market Education or something like that. And so the second of these two articles is where I lay out a blueprint for how we move from our current system to a completely privatized system. So I establish sort of three steps that we can do it. And of course, this would be done over the course of many, many years, possibly even decades. So the first step one would be to eliminate all federal government involvement in education, which would mean abolishing the Federal Department of Education, repealing all national education regulations and standards, things like Common Core, abolish any federal taxation that there is for government schools, and then abolish all national standards established by the federal government, Federal Department of Education. And then the second step would be to eliminate all state government involvement in education, which would then mean abolishing all states departments of education, then repealing all government mandated curricula and testing standards. It would involve decertifying, and this is a big one that you mentioned earlier. Yeah. And this, I'm a huge fan of this.
I would start with that.
And that would be the easiest one to decertify the so-called education school, right? Because this is the one area in education reform that virtually everybody in America agrees with, except the teacher and the professors of the education schools.
Yep. Nobody likes them.
Nobody, including teachers.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Everybody hates them. So I would abolish the so-called ed schools. And then finally, I would abolish all regulations controlling homeschooling.
Yep.
And then so we're sort of moving down, imploding power, education choice and power back to the local level. And so then we get to the local level, and then you eliminate local property taxes for education, implement universal education or tuition tax credits, and then finally start auctioning off the schools.
Yep.
Take the government schools and then auction them off. And then you open up the market, and of course the market will fill the need.
I would actually take all the money from auctioning off the schools and put it in a foundation, private foundations, to fund education for poor kids. And that way you get that stupid objection out of the way. And you'd raise a lot of money because it's great real estate. I'm not sure that.
Oh.
Yeah, it's great real estate. The schools are in great places.
Yeah. And, I mean, the fact of the matter is everybody wants their children educated, right? Everybody wants their children educated.
Oh, yeah.
And so I often hear, you know, there's kind of an elitist assumption that let's just say certain social orders or certain sociological descriptions or groupings of people in the United States don't care about their kids enough to let them be educated. This is a lie. It is a big lie. I promise you, you go into your local trailer park.
Oh, everybody. No, And you know this book by James Tooley, you know, Beautiful Tree, about these little private schools and the worst slums in India and the worst slums in Nigeria and parents who have nothing, you know, spend whatever they have on sending their kids to little private schools within those slums, and they find the resources and they want their kids to have a better life than they have, and they realize that education is the means to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in Hyderabad, India, in Lagos, Nigeria, something like where they have government schools where every child can go to a free, quote unquote, government school, 70% of these desperately poor families are sending their kids to private school. So how's that possible? Well, the fact of the matter is that there are no regulations controlling the creation, the startup of these schools. And so what you end up having are something actually more akin to what you had in the 18th century. And this is how John Adams and Thomas Jefferson were educated. That is, you have somebody who, you know, let's say in Hyderabad, puts a sign on his front stoop you know, and says, Ravi's a classical school, and he takes in five students.
Yeah.
Right? And he educates them.
Yeah.
And there are thousands of these kinds of schools in Hyderabad and Lagos. And of course, the cost is absolutely minimal.
Because they're in the slum. The school is in the slum. And there's
precisely.
No there's no swimming pool. There's no basketball court. There's none of that. But they get a great or they get a good education by people who care. And people are trying to make a living doing it.
Yeah.
The book that describes all this is called The Beautiful Tree. So highly recommended, guys. You can find it on Amazon. What's the name of the guy? Tooley. Tooley?
James Tooley.
James Tooley.
Yeah.
So, all right. So that's kind of the ultimate solution. Objectivism wins and we privatize the schools. Ain't happening in my lifetime and your lifetime. So what I love about what's happening at Clemson is at the scale where you can control reality, right? You are making these changes. Now you're getting the kids older than we would like, but trying to undo a lot of the damage. And let me just say, this is a project of what Brad is going to talk about, project of the Clemson Institute for the Study of Capitalism, which I'm really proud to be involved in really from day one at Clemson. I'm on the board. I'm on Brad's board of the Institute, and Brad's done a fantastic job with this. But this is relatively, this is a dream that Brad came to me about, I don't know, 5-6 years ago and said, I know how to change the world. Like, I've got it. And he described what he's going to describe. And it sounded great. You know, the university's never going to agree to this. This is never going to happen. And it's happening. It's fantastic. So go ahead, Brad, with that introduction.
Yeah. Well, that's a great introduction.
Yeah.
And I love it. And thank you.
Yeah.
So let me just step back for a second and tell your audience, a little bit about the Clemson Institute for the Study of Capitalism. And my elevator speech is that we're America's first and only university-based teaching and research center dedicated to exploring the moral foundations of capitalism, right? And there are, of course, as you know, and as your audience knows, there are scores of free market think tanks all over the United States, but in virtually every single instance, they're run by economists, which means that they make the argument that capitalism is good because it's the most productive and efficient economic system ever devised by man, which, of course, is absolutely true.
Yep.
The problem with that argument is that even Karl Marx knew that and said so in the Communist Manifesto.
Nobody cares.
The problem with capitalism for Marx is that it's immoral and unjust. And so for 150 years, Marx and his descendants captured the moral high ground. And in the post-World War II era, Hayek and Friedman et al., they captured the economic high ground. But in any battle of ideas between morality and economics, morality wins every single time, which is precisely why this country's been going down the road to socialism for 50, 60, 80 years. And so the Clemson Institute was created in a sense to recapture that moral high ground. And we started 12 years ago as a one-person shop, me. And over the course of these last 12 years, we've grown and expanded. And 5 or 6 years ago, I came up with this idea, which would eventually become what we now today call the Lyceum Scholars Program. What is it? Well, it's a scholarship program. We give 10 scholarships per year to incoming freshmen. Those scholarships are renewable over their 4 years. And in return for the scholarship, the students are required to take a curriculum of 8 classes together as a cohort. That's one class each semester. And we use a great books approach to studying the history of liberty, capitalism, the American founding, and the principles of moral character in this curriculum. So very quickly, the 8 classes, freshman year, they do a course called Introduction to Political Philosophy and a second course called Wisdom of the Ancients, which is, of course, an ancient Greek and Roman moral thought. Sophomore year, a course on the American founding and a course in American political thought. Junior year, 2 courses in constitutional law. And then senior year, they do a course called Political Theory of Capitalism. And then the capstone course is called Wisdom of the Moderns, which is a course in modern moral thought, Shakespeare through Adam Smith and Jane Austen and Dostoevsky up to Ayn Rand. So that's the curriculum of the course. Of the program. And as I said, we've got a small group of 10 students each year. So it's very small, very elite. We get top flight students, and then they take these eight classes together as a cohort over their 4 years. But what really makes this program unique and distinctive is that we have created what we call the Socratic Tutor Program. So each student, each Lyceum scholar, is assigned what we call a Socratic Tutor. And a Socratic Tutor is one of the faculty members associated with the Lyceum program. And the Socratic Tutor meets with his or her tutees every other week for 45 minutes to an hour. And the purpose is twofold. First, to help these young people translate theory into practice. So for instance, I'm teaching Wisdom of the Ancients this semester, and we're reading Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, a challenging book for anybody to read. And the question is, how does your typical 18-year-old 21st century American translate this very difficult, challenging book into their life here now today? The second purpose of the Socratic Tutor Program is to get these young people to think seriously and deeply about the question of moral character and their own moral character in particular. And in doing that, we're sort of resurrecting something that hasn't been done in American higher education probably for at least 100 years. In fact, I think it really goes back to before the Civil War. And we believe that there is an intimate relationship between moral character and the principles of a free society. You can't have a free society made up of moral reprobates, mm-hmm. right? And so anyway, the Socratic Tutor is challenged to get these kids to just think seriously and deeply about their moral character. So that's the program. I mean, that's the curriculum of the program. If I could just take one more second say something about the extraordinary growth of this program. So, you know, when I came up with the idea 5 years ago, it was just a dream and a vision. The good news is that Clemson University has been a remarkably supportive home for this program. I mean, I really thought it would take several years to get up off the ground.
Yeah, I think all of us did.
In the end, we thought entrepreneurially, and we were able to launch it within a few months. And when we started our first ever marketing campaign for our first ever class, and at the time I had a staff of two, none of us were trained in marketing. We had a pathetic budget of $5,000 to market this brand new program to get our first class. I was expecting maybe 30 to 50 applications. First year, we had 200 from students in 22 states. Second year, we had 400 from students in 32 states. Last year, we had 511 from students in 38 states. And I'm pleased to be able to announce tonight that we've closed our application for next year, and we've had 564 applications from students in almost 40 states.
For 10 spots,
yeah. So by the numbers, we're actually more competitive than Harvard.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's amazing. And it would be great. I mean, one of the dreams is to grow this. I mean, there's no reason this shouldn't have 20, 30, 40. You just need to grow the faculty, because that kind of intimate relationship between the faculty and the students, that kind of real learning that's going on, you can't scale that unless you scale the faculty as well. So it's quite expensive.
Yeah, it is. And we've actually, the demand for this program has been so high at Clemson. I mean, we've got every year we've got scores of students who come to us and say, we want to be a part of this program, but I didn't know about it when I was in high school. I didn't get a chance to apply. How can I be a part of it? So we've created a second or parallel track called the Lyceum Fellows Program. And the Lyceum Fellows Program allows them to be in the Lyceum program. The bad news is there's no scholarship attached to it. The good news, though, is that it's much more flexible. They only have to take 6 of the 8 classes, and rather than taking them lock, stock, and barrel in order with their cohort, they can do them whenever they want and in whatever order they want. In a year and a half, we went from 0 to 140 Lyceum fellows in our program.
Wow.
So, I mean, we have an expectation that the fellows program itself will go over 200 and then approach 300 in the years to come. And you're right. I mean, the only thing that's limiting us right now to growing either the scholars program or the fellows program is just resources, right?
Resources.
Teach all these students. I need faculty and staff to run the program. I can promise you it takes a lot of time to read 564 applications, each of which has three essays.
Yep.
So I need more staff and I'm hoping and expecting that we will over the course of the next 5 years.
No, it's a great program and it's just an illustration of you know, things can be done. Things are getting better in pockets. As a culture, maybe not, certainly not in the world of politics, but in pockets where it counts. Because at the end of the day, the battle we face is education, education, education. We've been talking about this all for the last hour and a half, right? It's all about education. It's about ideas. It's about changing the whole educational establishment and the way kids think or the way kids are taught ideas, facts, and progress is being made. Don't despair out there. All right. Any parting thoughts, Brad? And we'll call this a night.
Yeah.
I'm
bullish. I'm sometimes it's hard to be positive about the future, but I'm bullish on the future, and I'm bullish for a couple of reasons. What can't go on forever won't, right? And at a certain point, you know, we have to bottom out. And in many ways, I think we are bottoming out. And I think there are two extraordinarily hopeful signs for the future. The first is what we see happening right now on the web and through YouTube, and what you're doing with your show, and what's going on with Dave Rubin on the Rubin Report, and what we see happening with Jordan Peterson, right? There's a kind of an alternative universe. There's an alternative way to deliver education, knowledge, right, that did not exist 20 years ago. And so I think the higher ed monopoly, and it really is a monopoly, is starting to crack at the seams, right? There is an enormous amount of disaffected young people, young men in particular, right, who are done with the universities, right? I mean, why spend $200,000 at a university, right, if you're going to be denounced for 4 years by your professors, right? So that's a hopeful. And the second is homeschooling, without question. There is a homeschooling revolution that is taking place in this country, where ordinary, everyday people from across the economic spectrum, from across the religious spectrum, from across various social orders and ethnicities in the United States, everybody now is homeschooling. The face of homeschooling is as diverse as the face of America, right? Yeah. And that is an extraordinarily hopeful sign. And what it shows us is that ordinary, everyday people are taking responsibility for the education of their own children, right? And after 100-plus years of basically turning your children over to the government to be educated, people have said, that's it, nope, no more. I'm going to educate my own children. That is a revolution. And I want, my last word to you is to express my heartfelt thanks to homeschooling parents, and more particularly to all of the homeschooling mothers in the United States who do, I think, the vast burden of homeschooling. They are the revolutionaries of the future.
No, it's certainly exciting. How can people get a hold of you? Why don't you give your email again if you want people to use it, or at least Facebook or something that people can, people ask if you have a channel on YouTube, if they can follow you on Facebook or Twitter or anything like that. So you've now walked into it, Brad.
Yeah. So the short answer to that question is no, but let's just say something is in the works for me to stick my head out of the ivory tower. And I think maybe by this summer we'll be launching some alternative media outlets.
Good.
But people can contact me, as I said earlier, through my email, which is tthomp2@clemson.edu. That's tthomp2@clemson.edu. Or just look for me on Facebook. I'm under C, the letter C, Bradley Thompson, and friend me on Facebook. And I'm certainly happy to share my article with you.
Good. Thanks, Brad. This has been great.
All right.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Yeah.
I'll be back Saturday morning with Amy Peacock, and then again next week from London. See you, Brad. Bye.
Ciao. Thanks, Ron. Bye.